educators who retired, which presents about 30% of the ethnic teaching staff. So, you know, at a time when we were trying to increase numbers, we lost some great teachers, and we're going to be struggling to try to rebound from that.
The Department of Environmental Conservation says the Chevron Mississippi had trouble with an amplifier, which carries signals from the ship's rudder to the bridge. Larry Dietrich with DEC Prevention and Response says the empty inbound Mississippi notified the DEC and Alyeska Tuesday morning of the trouble, which was detected during a routine inspection.
As it turns out, there were backup systems to the steering unit that were used that allowed the vessel to come in under its own rudders without actually having to tether up or tie off to any of the escort vessels.
Dietrich says three Alyeska vessels safely escorted the tanker to the terminal Tuesday. The tanker underwent repairs Wednesday and will be ready to sail after a Coast Guard inspection. Dietrich says such incidents are not uncommon for tankers.
We've had a number of cracked hulls. As you recall, we had the Kenai near miss. We had the Overseas Ohio that had hit the iceberg, and a number of other ones all since 89. So, incidents, you know, continue to occur. These aren't anything that were necessarily failures, but it just shows that problems can and do come up.
The DEC's Dietrich says the incident underlines the importance of Alyeska's safe escort vessel response system. SERV's regulatory manager Dennis McGuire says Tuesday's response was basically an exercise.
Feels good. Having just gone over and assisted Crowley on the recovery of their barge that broke in half. You know, so this is, you know, two instances, you know, within pretty much a week where the escort system has, you know, really proven, you know, what it's capable of doing.
In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
And that is set to be in place on January 31st. We are working with the North Slope producers to keep throughput high through these weeks and days before the temporary back pressure is in place. And how that works is if they can keep throughput up above about 1.46 at pump station 1, then we can eliminate the vibrations at Thompson Pass. There are several types of monitoring we're doing. We're doing pressure pulsation monitoring, and that's information that goes into a modem and is transmitted to experts who analyze it. And then we're also doing environmental monitoring, and that's to make sure that there's no spill or hydrocarbon leak associated with the site. The hydrocarbon sensors take readings every minute, and those readings are transmitted via computer lines to experts who can analyze the information, and they look at it twice a day just to make sure that there's no hydrocarbon leak or any kind of associated spill.
The McGrath Airport runway upgrade and apron project has been on the drawing boards for over 20 years. And every time the project is about to get underway, another roadblock is encountered. Rex Young, area planner for the Alaska Department of Transportation, was one of the state officials at the meeting. He says he didn't expect a very warm reception from those attending the meeting here in McGrath.
Actually, I thought it went, very well. The community was showing interest in, you know, getting the project done. There's a high frustration level there within the community, and I can understand that. This project has been on and off for quite a few times.
February 3rd and 4th, the State Aviation Project Evaluation Board will meet to evaluate projects on a statewide needs list. Each project will be ranked and a priority set for funding. The criteria is very specific, including community support, a resolution by the City Council, and identifying economic gains for the area. Each is ranked numerically and ranked with other projects in the state.
We put together a complete packet, justification statement on the project, and then we look at each of the factors in the aviation criteria, and, you know, we start trying to justify, you know, the higher score or lower score, whatever it happens to be. Nowadays,
from the Federal Aviation Administration's Aviation Trust Fund. As money comes in from the Federal Trust Fund, projects at the top of the state's list would be funded, and as federal money becomes available, projects in order of ranking would then be funded. The runway apron project would cost an estimated $3.6 million, and when completed, would create a safe area where heavy aircraft, such as cargo planes, could load and unload without mixing with smaller aircraft. They have to be separated to meet FAA safety standards. The runway upgrade would cost between $6 and $7 million.
The apron project could go, if funding is available, as early as May, the advertisement can be done for the advertisement for bids for the contract. The runway itself, as we were talking last night, if the funding is available, depending on how it ranks with this project evaluation board, 2001, 2002 may be a good year.
Residents of McGrath are anxious for the airport projects to get underway. Mayor Glenn Hanway said at the meeting, McGrath is economically tied to the airport, and without it, McGrath would dry up and blow away. Young says because of the limited money available, the state has to weigh McGrath's needs against other projects in the state.
This is, an ongoing process, and unfortunately, as McGrath knows, it's not always a sure thing. But, it's looked better now than it has for a long time.
Residents of McGrath will find out where the projects rank on the state's priority list February 4th. In McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
3, 2, 1. The 140 or so miles of abandoned rail bed along the Copper River between Cordova and Chitna have been the subject of development for a long time. Former Governor Hickel pushed for a road until Governor Knowles took over and began pursuing the trail idea. Department of Natural Resources Parks and Recreation spokesman Ron Crenshaw says the two projects should not be misconstrued.
This is not a road project in any way, shape, or form. In fact, what would have to happen before we went on to the next planning step would be we would have to put the environmental impact statement and the road concept to bed. People who are pro-road or anti-road will be curious what this trail, what impact the trail might have on other people's plans and ideas for a future road.
Crenshaw says the state is approaching the trail idea with few preconceptions and is meeting with residents to see whether and how it goes forward. Ricky Ott was among 50 to 60 Cordova residents that attended the first such meeting Tuesday. Ott says the majority of those on hand told state officials the project should be set upon by developing a local trail system first to gauge impact.
We sure would like to see the trail system developed in Cordova and in the city limits, but also you could even go out to 50 Mile. And then that would provide an infrastructure for people to use the system. We could kind of see what rescue equipment or personnel we would need. We would see what safety measures we need to take. We'd see how expensive it is before we take the next step.
Ott says there's also strong consensus that local trails be for non-motorized use, but the debate remains as to whether vehicles should be allowed along a trail running all the way to Chitna. Ott says locals also told officials any trail would provide increased access to the Copper River, heightening the ongoing battle over Copper River salmon. The DNR plans additional public meetings on the project this winter in Valdez, Chitna, and Fairbanks. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Five years and $350 million into the project, the Fort Knox mine is producing its first gold. On Friday, officials opened their secure gold room to invite guests in for a behind-the-scenes look. They gathered around a furnace to watch two workers pour the first bars. Controller Larry Lynch says after investing so much money, it was nice to see the mine begin returning revenue to its owners.
It's been pretty exciting. I've been in mining for 32 years with the same company, and we've been with operations all the time. And then to see a project this big from ground zero come all the way up in a construction mode, it's been great. And then to set it up to go into operations like I'm seeing here, that's quite a thrill in my career.
By the time the pour was over, two workers had produced three bars. The the largest about the size of a bread loaf, weighing in at 85 pounds and valued at $460,000. The total run for the day topped $800,000. And once the bars cooled, politicians, business leaders, the media, and other visitors spent the next half hour mugging for cameras and hefting the bars.
Okay. Get a hold.
Oh, my word.
Got it?
I got you. Oh, come on, please. Oh, my Lord.
You don't ever want to say that.
Here, take it.
All right, now I got to get rid of this thing. Thank you. Thanks.
Okay, Larry.
Oh. Hand in there.
I got it.
We need steel bows in here along.
Oh, wow.
During the next 12 years that mine officials expect the project to operate, they hope to average producing some 900 ounces of gold a day as they mill 36,000 tons of ore round the clock. Everything about the mine seems huge. Its buildings, the milling machinery, conveyors, and trucks all combine to make this the biggest gold mine in the state and rank it in the top 10 nationwide. Alaska Miners Association Director Steve Burrell says Fort Knox and other mines will help push the industry's economic contribution this year to about $1 billion statewide, and he predicts more to come.
If we look back in 10 years and see five more mines the size of Fort Knox, I won't be surprised. I don't know which ones are going to be or just exactly where, but I think the opportunities here, Fairbanks District for certain, are just tremendous. And all throughout the interior, for that matter. A lot of other opportunities for the mining industry.
Burrell says Friday's pour serves as a milestone in the Fairbanks District's history that in 100 years has developed from a few colors in a pan to big money in people's pockets. With the exception of the stern-faced guards, everyone at the pour was having fun. Even refinery operator Jack Mahoney was smiling, though he admitted the fanfare will be followed by more mundane realities.
Of course, we've done it for the past week, and I mean, after a while, it starts to get old, you know, that you don't think any more of this than you do pouring lead or anything else. It just gets to be a job after a while.
Based on what Mahoney says, it's a job that people working at the mine appear glad to have. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. The Department of Community and Regional Affairs recommended Yakutat be granted just half the area approved based on cultural and economic ties it says diminish west of the Ducktow River. DCRA Boundary Commission Assistant Dan Bockhurst says the intent was to preserve the area from there to Cape Suckling for a potential Prince William Sound borough, but that the LBC has other priorities.
I think the thing that stands out in my mind about the commission's decision to annex the entire region was that they felt that the area of two Cape Suckling was a cohesive unit and that it would be poor public policy to divide the region so that it might be placed in two different borough governments.
Bocker says the Boundary Commission did leave out 184 square miles in the northwestern corner of the Yakutat annexation for a future Copper River borough. He says the LBC will take comments from the public through January 8th on its decision. The commission's final recommendation will go to the legislature for approval. Prince William Sound communities fought the Yakutat annexation and will file opposition with the Boundary Commission. Whittier City Manager Dave Morgan says the annexation would open the door for other takeovers.
It's sort of a gentleman's agreement that you don't step over into the other model borough, even if it isn't organized yet, and I think if this thing makes it all the way through, all bets are off.
Morgan says Whittier fears annexation by the Anchorage or Kenai boroughs. Whittier, Cordova, Chenega Bay, Tetitlik, and Valdez plan to study the economics of a Prince William Sound borough. Morgan says the legislature came close to passing a mandatory borough bill last year and will likely pass one this coming session. Alaska's Constitution says boroughs will be formed, but most of the state remains unorganized. The primary economic function of a borough is to shift the burden of education funding from state to local government. Yakutat would pick up two additional schools with its annexation. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Former Ruby Postmaster Agnes Wright was killed in June while at work. Abram Walter has been charged with the murder. Authorities say Walter, an experienced woodsman who grew up on a homestead near McGrath, walked to Ruby after staging his death on the Takotna River. State troopers picked him up after they linked him to a robbery at the Esther Post Office. A month after the murder, Ruby resident Katie Kangas said many from the Yukon River Village had named Walter as a suspect weeks before.
I'd always heard stories about the Walters and how they were able to walk from the Novi River to the McGrath area, and that they were well acquainted with living out in the woods.
Walter faces federal charges for the murder, and the Attorney General has until January 20th to decide whether to seek the death penalty under federal law. If so, Walter will face trial sometime after October. Postal officials still have not hired a permanent replacement for Wright. In 1996, Fort Yukon residents rejected a push to close the city-owned liquor store. After 16-year-old Martin Carroll killed himself while intoxicated, the boy's father led the campaign. But others voted against the initiative, saying that closing the store wouldn't solve the problem. All three charter schools approved so far by the State Board of Education are in the interior. The Chinook Charter School in Fairbanks just completed its first semester, and the Takotna Alternative School on the Kuskokwim River focused on long-term projects, like a recent salmon count. Students learned math, grammar, and other skills while compiling the research. The Galena School District has plans to enroll students in the fall of 1997 for a vocational technical school, which will be housed in the former Air Force Base. Rural school districts have until the end of June to apply for one of the five remaining charters available to them. The Illinois Creek Gold Mine is offline for the winter. Last summer, crews set up camp and moved tons of equipment to the remote site, about 50 miles southwest of Galena. Workers in Galena transferred dump trucks and other mining equipment from barges to cargo planes, like the C-133, the only flying plane of its kind. Flight engineer Ski Kozlowski says Alaska's largest non-military cargo plane flies into the same remote dirt runways as other cargo aircraft, but with a special advantage.
Whatever that piece of equipment is, just drive it right in, tie it down, and we'll be out of here. Quick turnaround. That's what makes this airplane nice. It's big inside where a lot of the equipment doesn't have to be tore down.
Residents up and down the river are looking forward to returning to jobs at Illinois Creek after breakup. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
One need only look to the pocketbook to find this year's big stories. In October, city voters agreed to sell off their phone, electric, and other utilities. The transactions are not yet finished, but the $153 million deal means that many utility employees will be working for new companies, and citizens will find different bills, often higher, in their mail. Dealmaker Brian Rogers says the campaign was tough.
We were scared in the last week. We saw the barrage of advertising against the sale, and I think there were real concerns by all the parties that it could go down as a result of that.
The sale passed with 54% of the vote. Borough-wide, voters agreed to spend $64 million to build new schools, and they voted to close bars earlier. While those issues affect most everyone who lives in the borough, a different deal has cost hundreds of others. Business regulators forced Regine Bonham's World Plus airline ticket brokerage out of business. They say she was running an illegal Ponzi scheme where new investors paid the debts of old investors. Bonham's not been charged with any crime, but a bankruptcy trustee is suing her clients, trying to recover up to $60 million. Earlier in the year, she saw herself as a victim of overzealous regulators trying to keep her from doing business.
All I'm going to do is try and get back into my business that I should have never been taken out of that business and operate it because I care about the creditors. I seem to be the only one that cares about them.
In addition to losing much of their initial capital, the investors face fines and big legal fees. The situation's hit many well-to-do bankers, lawyers, police, and government officials, as well as others lured by promises they'd earn easy money. In a different matter, the city police chief himself faces a month-long suspension for what the mayor calls poor management. Much of that was prompted when an audit discovered $12,000 was missing from the police evidence locker. The money's still missing, and no one's been charged in the crime. City police also took heat after a teenage bystander was killed in a high-speed chase. And state troopers were also criticized when they failed to follow up on a report of stranded motorists on the Denali Highway. As it turns out, three people died hiking out for help after they drove their car into a snowdrift. Natural resource issues remain hot and battles continue brewing over access. Airboat owners face more people who say the noisy craft should be banned. Snow machiners face similar pressure, though this year they successfully fought off proposals that would have closed them out of some areas south of Denali. Both of these fights serve to spawn a coalition of people who want to ensure enough quiet places remain convenient to the road system. Racism and intolerance still bubble under the Fairbanks skin. Controversy soared earlier this year when some high school students found white supremacist leaflets around classrooms. That prompted a series of visits by civil rights activists, including Rosa Parks, the woman who helped spark the Montgomery bus boycotts 40 years ago.
We need to be more mindful of the problems that we do face and rid our minds of prejudice.
Some supporters of gays and lesbians were disappointed when University Regents again refused to add sexual orientation to its list of minority classes protected from job discrimination. And in business, mining dominated the headlines. After running over budget by many millions of dollars, the Fort Knox mine produced its first gold. And in spite of changes in timber management, plans for growing a bigger interior wood industry have borne little fruit. Finally, John Schandelmeyer became the second person to twice win the Yukon Quest. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Three, two, one. No one's sure whether the cold water temperatures of Prince William Sound protect it from invasion by non-native sea life carried north in ballast water. Regional Citizens Advisory Council spokesperson Patty Ginsburg says the Smithsonian was hired to conduct the first real investigation. Zebra mussels introduced into the Great Lakes via ballast water have caused environmental and economic damage, and San Francisco Bay has also been inhabited by numerous invasive organisms. Ginsburg says concerns are most often focused on species from foreign waters.
But the fact is, from what we're hearing, I mean, it sounds like the sources of the risk would be just as likely to come from domestic ports that have been invaded by species or you know, species that are native to one port and not native here. And the problem, of course, is if they don't have natural predators, then they can just, if it's a hardy species, they can just take over.
The RCAC's Ginsburg says a voluntary measure which would have encouraged tankers going from one domestic port to another to exchange ballast outside Alaska waters was dropped from the National Aquatic Nuisance Act this fall. Tankers traveling from foreign ports are already advised to do so when weather conditions are safe. Initial study results from the Smithsonian will be made available during a March workshop co-sponsored by the RCAC and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Ginsburg says the invasive species project will cost about $73,000. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
At least not the Santa Claus who's in the Alaska Air National Guard. According to Tech Sergeant Bruce Gazaway of the Alaska Air Guard, Operation Santa Claus has a new focus.
This year we have focused on villages which, according to the information we had, had certain economic problems. And so our focus has been on those which we are able to identify as having a higher rate of poverty.
In the past, the Alaska Air Guard Santa visited McGrath basically because it was easy to get to.
Quite frankly, we've been kind of picking communities out of the hat. Having a big runway had more to do with Operation Santa Claus than community need. And so what we did this year was do a statistical analysis of villages based on the last census report of trying to establish the poverty rate. And we chose villages in each corporate area that had a high index of poverty.
This year, nine villages scattered across Alaska who are far more in need than McGrath will be getting a visit from the Alaska Air National Guard's Operation Santa Claus with toys and gifts donated from people all across the state of Alaska. In McGrath, I'm Scott Stevens.
it spread down the quarterway, up the stairs, and then as it progressed down the quarterway in the basement, it entered in through common plumbing walls between the apartments up pipe chases. From there, it broke out into most of the apartments in C building and several of the apartments in D building through the bathroom walls, which were common between the apartments, and then also into the attic space.
The ones that are destroyed are going to be just about everything. They have basically the destroyed apartments. There's nothing left in those. The others need varying degrees of some maybe clothing to replace stuff that was water soaked and is no longer usable. There have been donations already of some food items. We've got several donations of clothing. We have also started to receive some donations of furniture type items for them to get reestablished with. Linens and bedding are always needed. Pots and pans and dishes will also be used because, like I say, they're basically starting over.
About a month ago, the Alaska Supreme Court ordered the DEC to give Dan Lawn back his old terminal oversight job or some other mutually agreeable position. Lawn has had no communication with DEC administration, however, since early December, when they told him he was being laid off from his current job in charge of waste as of February. With the days counting down, the DEC has finally agreed to meet with Lawn and his union representative.
We're looking to sit down with Dan and kind of finding what kind of position he's interested in and seeing what's available. We need to just kind of bring closure to this and move on.
The DEC has assigned Spill Prevention and Response Director Kurt Fredrickson to work out a deal with Lawn. He says Lawn's old job no longer exists, but that the department will offer him a variety of others which involve aspects of terminal oversight. Lawn's representative with the Alaska Public Employees Union, Bob Watt, says he and Lawn will negotiate in good faith despite continued legal action by the state.
The DEC legal department wants the Supreme Court to remand it back to the Superior Court and let the Superior Court determine which position Dan Lawn should go into. Now, to me, this is just dilatory tactics on behalf of the state. They're trying to drag their feet as long as possible.
Watt says Lawn hasn't given up either. Lawn filed a retaliatory discharge complaint with the Department of Labor earlier this month, accusing the DEC of harassing him, monitoring his private life, and laying him off for pointing out DEC and industry failings. Courts aside, Watt says Friday's meeting is an unprecedented step in Lawn's seven-year battle with the department, which began with his 1989 demotion following the Exxon Valdez oil spill. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Fairbanks, if we go along, it came on its own by 1904 or 1905. It was clearly a big district. Fairbanks began to decline about the time of World War I. The rich placers, like on Clary Creek and Fairbanks Creek and Nome Creek and Esther Creek, were all very, very good placer deposits. Were being very intensively mined and were running out of the rich ores. And clearly in decline. World War I took away a lot of the young, experienced miners, and many of them did not return because they had seen the district declining. It looked like why return, basically? This was a good question, I suppose, to ask. There was a lot of concern that what the future of Fairbanks would hold, but several things transpired to change all this, and they act in unison, really. And you can judge for yourself what was the most important. One of which was the establishment of what we now call the University of Alaska. This was important to the future of the town. The School of Agriculture and Mines, you know, was the nucleus, but it was very important because it gave Fairbanks an important educational role for the whole territory. The second thing was the construction of the Alaska Railroad, supplied a cheap and efficient transportation method into the interior, which had previously relied solely on a riverboat access or trail access from Valdez along the Richardson Trail.
Highway. Okay.
You know, some of the early stampeders came up the Richardson Trail, and it took quite a few days to get in here. And, of course, riverboat traffic ends in October and starts up in May again, so it was a problem. So that allowed the interior to be developed more efficiently. And third, and you know, last but not least, was the entrance of a major mining firm into the interior, the USS R&M Company, the United States Smelting and Refining Company. They were based on the East Coast. I won't go into the details of how the financial transactions took place. That's an interesting history in itself. A really well-known and brilliant mining engineer by the name of Norman Steins had been on contract with Tsar Nicholas II looking at mining properties throughout Siberia and the Russian Far East for possible future gold developments for the Russian Empire. In 1917, of course, the Tsar was overthrown, and then later, of course, the Bolshevik Revolution took place, and Steins was more or less out of favor. He had been working on contract with the former Tsarist regime.
And he was out of a job.
And he was out of a job, so he came back across the Bering Straits en route to the east coast of the United States and some of his financing friends he had, and he took a look at the Nome District first. And saw great promise in the Nome District, which was also in decline because the rich placers had been largely mined out. And he saw the potential for large, low-grade placer deposits being mined with machinery, mainly bucket line stacker dredges. And he began to immediately, plan for the establishment of and contracted with what became the Hammond Consolidated Goldfields Company to work several large bucket line stacker dredges on the Nome coastal plain. And then en route, he continued his travels and en route stopped through Fairbanks to take a look at Fairbanks because he realized this was a major district also that was in decline and saw the great potential of streams like Goldstream Valley, Clary Creek, and Fairbanks Creek and others to be exploited the same way as the Nome district was.
What showed him the potential?
That's hard to explain. I mean, just to someone, a bright young engineer with a lot of experience seeing that and looking through the mining records, seeing that there was a lot of ground left to be mined if the challenges of permafrost and seasonality of mining couldn't be overcome. There were a lot of doubters at that time. There was a dredging industry in Alaska, but there was a lot of failures in the dredging industry, particularly on the Seward Peninsula. Lots of more money lost than won, really, in the early phases of it, mainly because of seasonality of dredging in Alaska. It could only be done 6 months a year or so. It was very expensive to remove the frozen overburden, and it had previously required heat through steam. In 1918, an engineer by the name of Miles perfected a cold water thawing technology by just simply pumping cold water into the ground and over a period of a year or two, thawing the gravels with cold water thawing. This didn't require heating, and this saved a lot of money.
Mm, I bet.
And this was a major new technology that Norm Steins and his colleagues took into account. It was perfected in 1919 on the Seward Peninsula, which incidentally is a technology that also went all over the world. So Norm Steins went back to financiers in Boston, and eventually, through a period of time, the USS R&M Company obtained controlling interest not only in the Fairbanks Mining District, but the Nome District. And they began acquiring ground. This was a great time to acquire ground because a lot of the drift miners had gone, had given up. A hard rock mining industry had started but faded, and the rich gold veins that were found were never really, there was never really tonnage involved, and so it was small scale. And so this firm had money. And so what they did is, through a $28 million development phase that took place during the 1920s, which was frankly a lot of money at the time.
Wow, $28 million.
That's right. That's a lot of money at the time.
They
began to systematically acquire ground. They constructed they needed water to hydraulically strip overburden and there wasn't enough water in the local area, so they constructed the Davidson Ditch System, which was 90 miles long from near the head of the Chattanooga River down into the Fairbanks Mining District, where they hydraulically removed overburden in the Chattanooga and Goldstream and Fairbanks Creek drainages. At one time, any one time, they'd have over 100 giants operating. You know what a giant is?
No, it's a giant nozzle, right?
A giant is a nozzle that directs a stream of water at great pressure onto a working face, and through that process actually thaws the overburden. It being largely silt is actually, literally goes into a slurry and moves downstream and downslope from the operation. But it required a lot of water. The Davidson Ditch required that. At one time, they had nearly 2,000 people working on this project, constructing the Davidson Ditch, and in fact employed steam shovels that were originally worked the Panama Canal project. They actually brought some of those, that same equipment that built the Panama Canal at the turn of the century. They planned on eventually putting in production 8 bucket line stacker dredges, and they did, in fact, by 1940, have all 8 in production. This required the use of electric power, because they were all electrically driven dredges. So it required the construction of a power plant in downtown Fairbanks off Illinois Avenue. It required the construction of a main office for engineering staff, which is the brick building you see on Illinois Avenue, and a large shop for repair and maintenance of these large pieces of equipment, these big bucket line stacker dredges, and an electric power grid from the power plant into these remote sites like Chattanooga and Goldstream, Esther, and other which supplied power.
And the remnants of that
still around, and we still see these Chattanooga Roadhouse. In Esther, you see the Malamute Saloon and that other area. The metal buildings you see there, the metal sided buildings, are actually FE Company buildings that postdate the early gold rush activities, and the Chena Pump House was constructed to acquire water for the Cripple Creek pay streak, which was a late discovery and a late development that took place in the 30s and 40s, which were mighty dredge 10 operated. And all this required a lot of a capital and a large employment base. They actually had at one point the employment statistics show about 1,500 employees, both seasonal and permanent, that work for the FE Company. The FE Company being the local subsidiary of USSR&M.
So this became a company town.
This was a company town, no doubt. No doubt about it. During the 30s and 40s, and maybe up to about 1950 or so, it was a company town. But then, of course, the economy changed after that.
Okay. Thanks.
This route sort of skirts it on the western and the northern borders of the flats, so we're missing the major part of the habitat in the middle. And as far as access, it's, like I said, it's not going to be a long straight line, and, you know, some people may find their way over there so they can use the access underneath for their snowmobiles, but I don't think it'll be much of a change from what it already is. People use that area quite extensively already.
Area city and village representatives met Friday in Valdez to discuss what a Prince William Sound borough might look like and do. Valdez Assistant City Manager Dave Dangle says priorities were laid out for a borough feasibility study. He says various geographic boundaries will be looked at for a borough with limited powers of taxation and education.
What you would see is you'd see a city tax for operating the general government of the city, and then you'd see a borough tax on top of that for funding education. Borough-wide.
Dangle says the feasibility study will determine whether the two taxes sum would be comparable to current city taxes. Until recently, the Sound was sluggish to consider the idea of more government. So far, only Cordova and Whittier have pledged monetary support for the borough study. Cordova City Manager Scott Janke says it's time to get on the offensive because Senate Bill 30 could make boroughs mandatory this session.
That legislation would create this official unorganized borough, and the state would tax them 6 mils to pay for the regional school district. So one way or the other, people are going to be paying. If there's a borough, they have a better chance, better opportunity to elect officials that will make decisions rather than having a state agency make decisions for them.
Janke says Prince William Sound communities will lobby the legislature to disapprove the Yakutat annexation until they can develop their own borough proposal. Yakutat claims traditional and economic ties to the area, but opposers say the annexation unfairly takes lands from Prince William Sound model borough boundaries. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross. Three, two, one. Kenny Lake K through second graders often spend an hour and a half a day walking as a group back and forth to bathrooms at the high school because of plumbing problems at the elementary school. Parent Teacher Association Treasurer Julie Knutson grew up in Kenny Lake and went to school in the same modular units still serving as classrooms for kids today. She says one of the units is 41 years old, older than any in Alaska still used for a classroom.
We had somebody come through to do our evaluation for our application to Juno, and they said these buildings shouldn't even be used. Their power is poor for televisions, computers, the plumbing is going, the roof's leak whenever it gets warm. It's like, I mean, what else do you want to hear?
Knutson has been to Juno to try to improve Kenny Lake's standing with the Department of Education, but there are 28 schools ahead of them on the department's priority list. The near $3 million sought to add on to Kenny Lake High to accommodate the elementary school is just a small portion of the $534 million in construction monies and $146 million in maintenance funds being asked for by school districts statewide. The department says projects are ranked according to standard criteria across the board, and that ranking is much less an issue than the amount of money being made available by the legislature. Last year, legislators only spent $6.9 million on capital improvements for schools. District 35 Representative Gene Kubina says Kenny Lake's situation is a statewide problem.
Right now, there's about a $400 million backlog in school construction in the state. And as a state, because of our budget reductions, we have not funded virtually any school construction in the last few years. So my goal, I think, is to find a way to deal with this on a statewide issue, not just with our local problems. And one way to do that may be a bonding package that we could put together that will encompass the whole state and therefore take into our district as well. But we've got to find a way. We can't ignore the issues.
Kubina says the state's population is growing and school construction and maintenance projects won't go away. The formation of boroughs has long been considered an answer to local education funding, but Kubina is not sure whether another level of government could pay for itself in an economically depressed area like the Copper Basin. He says his constituents there have told him they don't want a borough. The legislature will be looking at which education building and maintenance projects it will fund during the upcoming session. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
For a kid who practically grew up learning to play hockey, Eric Dragas is now focused on a new task. Today, it's sitting comfortably in a manual wheelchair.
You don't look too comfy to me.
Like I'm tipping.
You are tipping. It's because that whole back is leaned back. Let me get super
rich. After 3 months of intense therapy at Craig Hospital in Denver, Eric measures progress in tiny increments. He's come a long way since he slammed into the boards and bruised his spinal cord. He can now move his arms, neck, and shoulders and operate an electric wheelchair. He lifts weights, but only at a couple pounds at a time, a far cry from the hundreds he used to hoist. But he says it's progress, and he's glad for it.
There's people here that are worse off than me, so I'm thankful that I wasn't on a ventilator or respirator. I can move around now and go in a car. I don't have any IVs or anything, and there's some people here that, I mean, they have three IV poles, and it's sad to see, but I'm just thankful for what I have.
Eric wound up in the hospital after he caught an edge during hockey practice. He hit the boards head first and awoke to find himself almost totally paralyzed. After 2 weeks in Fairbanks, he moved to Denver, where he's attended by family, nurses, and therapists, all trying to get him back together. In the dozen-plus years he's played hockey, he got used to the injuries, the two knee operations, the herniated disc, and the cuts and bruises, but says nothing prepared him for this.
Well, I'm the same person, just I was really independent before I got hurt, so it's kind of, that was a change, kind of depending on other people to help me out, but I mean, you learn to be patient, and you kind of have the attitude, when you're planning like house plans or van or anything, you hope for the best and plan for the worst.
Hospital staffers say his attitudes help speed his recovery. Many kid around with him, and he's made several trips to area hockey games. Occupational therapist Michelle Graff says few patients receive the same level of encouragement.
It's a unique situation, I think, because there's so many people that care about him. And there's so much support, even here in Colorado, where no one knew him before he was hurt. And now he's just made incredible amount of friendships, outside of the hospital. He's just got that type of personality, very outgoing, very caring, that I think that that's what makes things as easy for him as they've made it.
Graff says Eric also benefits from an insurance plan few people ever see. Because he was playing college hockey, Eric's covered by an NCAA policy that pays 100% of his medical costs for life. Father Mark Dragas says that, and $38,000 raised by hockey fans, has allowed the family to focus on Eric's recovery instead of the $1,500 daily hospital bill. The accidents also bound the family tighter together. Sister Heidi, a UAF freshman, says she and others are all learning to care for Eric.
My priorities have changed so dramatically. Like, my family is number one, and what goes on in my life and what goes on with, you know, my social life, my school life, that's all comes next. And I'm sure it's important, but, it changes your whole perspective on what's important.
But such injuries are not uncommon on the ice or in other contact sports. And while parents everywhere cringe when a young person falls, Mother Kathy Dragas says somehow people get through it, and she doesn't have any second thoughts on having her only son play hockey.
My kid was never on drugs. He's not an alcoholic. He was never hanging out on the street or in a street corner, or never got into trouble. I never had one day of grief from Eric, never. Things happen, things change, and you just have to deal with it. That's all.
Eric has another month to spend in Denver before he makes the transition home. It's then, aides say, he'll face the next hurdle, that of resuming life on the outside. For his part, Eric remains optimistic.
Everything before the accident went well, and other than the accident, everything after the accident's gone well, so I'll find a way somehow.
Family and friends plan a reception for Eric February 20th, a chance for him to thank people for the help he's received. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
And 3, 2, 1. Chugach Development Corporation is the primary subsidiary of the Prince William Sound Regional Native Corporation, Chugach, Alaska. Spokesman Bruce Posey says CDC will team with Information Technology Solutions of Washington, D.C. to provide computer service and support to the Navy station through the year 2000. Posey says Chugach is in a unique position to get government contracts because of its so-called 8A certification by the Small Business Administration.
Then they become automatically on the government bid list. As a minority-owned corporation, they receive preference because of that for these sole-source contracts, and they don't have to go to the competitive bid situation. They just got to be in the ballpark. And there's not very many corporations, regional corporations in Alaska that have qualified for this 8A classification. That's why it's such a feather in the cap for Chugach.
Posey says Chugach has received other government contracts in the past year, including those for facility maintenance at military air stations at Whidbey Island, Washington, and Wake Island in the mid-Pacific. Chugach hopes its alliance with a high-tech company under the latest deal will improve its ability to get government work. Posey says the lucrative contract provides jobs and income to support Chugach's cultural and scholarship programs. Chugach, Alaska has 1,200 members, of which about 50% live in the Prince William Sound area. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
Things are starting to stack up, I think, just because of the cold weather has gone on, you know, for, this is about the fifth or sixth day, I believe, that, you know, things are are getting cold, and there's certain places in the Yukon Flats, Beaver, and Stevens that we haven't been able to get to because of the 65 to 70. They're very extreme, and the runways aren't long and suitable for our turbines. So there's a couple places that haven't seen service for 4 or 5 days. Some people are still, or some schools are waiting for teachers still. Beaver has got about 2 or 3 teachers hanging around waiting for the temperatures to pick up higher than 60. Galena, I've been able to get back in service, and Barter Island, Anaktuvik. I think those are the only two that I'm aware of are Allakaket and Beaver. And, of course, Stevens, I think, is also missing some teachers and probably canceling a few classes because of it.
Tomorrow morning at exactly 5:07 a.m. Alaska time, 6 sextillion, 588 quintillion short tons of planet Earth halt their gradual tilt toward the north, and ever so slowly turn, turn, turn back toward the sun star, back toward the warmth and energy that gives us life. What if Earth breaks the laws of the universe, and the North Pole continues pointing away from the sun? Who would notice? A few scientists and a handful of nature lovers? Give it a couple of weeks, about the middle of January, with sunrise at 12:45 in the afternoon. Trust me, everybody will notice. We have evolved as children of the daylight. I am obsessed with being in the light this time of year. I need it like I need air and water. I must organize my time so I can monitor the long, slow dawn. By 8:30, the first light brings relief. Ah, another day, another chance. Through the windows as I work, I watch the stars disappear as a gradation from pale yellow to fuchsia expands behind the black silhouette of the Alaska Range, my southern horizon. By 10:45, only Venus strolls across the western sky. She whistles up her sun dog, who climbs the peaks of Mount Hayes and immediately dominates the sky. This is my signal to abandon my inside work and move on to the chores in the sunshine. In the daylight, I have all the answers. At midday, I sense when the sun's arc is complete, a mere 10 degrees above the snow. As the earth spins to the east, the sun begins its gentle descent down to the southwest. I harness the dog team and blaze out the trail of diamonds. By 2:30, we return in the twilight, satisfied to have stretched our legs in views. The sun has slipped down some crevasse on the other side of the mountains. From below the horizon, the last rays caress the underclouds with baby pink, coral, and lavender. The dogs curl up cozy in straw nest in their doghouses. I'm content to go back inside and curl my cold hands around a mug of hot tea. By 3 o'clock, the loaded moon canoe paddles out into the pale sea sky. The moon's slender crescents and wide roundings remind me of my own transformations, my own tides of taking in and giving out. By 4 o'clock, her course is marked by a few planets blinking as buoys, and within another hour, waves of stars begin signaling. The great winter sea sky has washed over the world. Hours later, I go out to feed the dogs. The sharp air bites the tip of my nose. No need to check the thermometer. As the dogs eat, I like to wait in the darkness. In 10 minutes, I can count 1,000 stars. In several hours, I could know the meaning of 1,000,000. They remind me that Earth has come from the stars, that the very atoms of my body began up there. But the space between the stars, there's the darkness of the longest winter night. This darkness teaches me of infinity and the place where my spirit was born. This darkness gives me cover to wonder who I am and where I fit in the immensity of the universe. Is the earth just a prayer wheel the angels spin for luck? The owl in the nearby woods echoes my wonderings. In the silence under these stars, aurora splashes across the sky in wild celebration, charged particles of energy or dancing souls of long-departed friends. No matter, the answers come clearly. We are all one. This is Mary Shields in Goldstream Valley, wishing you the wisdom of winter's darkness and the joy of bright days to come.
Most of the Alaska volcanoes, we tend to have much more like Redoubt and Spur, Augustine. They tend to be more explosive. They occur, they act up, they explode, and shoot up a plume, and then they quiet down. This is actually forming a nice like a rift system, showing nice or what you'd see in Hawaii, nice fountaining and that kind of thing. So it's not nearly as explosive, but still potential for putting up quite a bit of ash in the air, and Pavlov also has a history of doing this kind of thing on and off, and it can go from months to years like this. It kind of is very quiet, and all of a sudden it starts up and continues, and then can do this sort of thing on and off for quite some time.
Every time that we do any kind of training, we have to weigh the benefits of that training against inconvenience to the public. In this case, we received several phone calls that resulted in a reevaluation, and we reevaluated it and found that the extent of public inconvenience outweighed any benefits to us, to the Army.